Everybody knows the deal is rotten. Old Black Joe still picking cotton for your ribbons and bows. Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost. Everybody
welcome to the Lifeboat Hour, December 21st, 2014. We come to you on this momentous occasion of the shortest day and the longest night of the year in the Northern Hemisphere, also known as winter solstice.
Yes.
Those of us who live in industrially civilized cultures are inundated this time of year with the celebration of other holidays that occur around solstice and actually have their roots in solstice, but do not really honor it. And so tonight, I want to honor this dark time of the year, a time when it's quite natural to function more inwardly than outwardly. The beauty of solstice is that the ancients knew that while darkness was all around them, the light remained and could not be extinguished. For this reason, candles are so appropriate and so welcome during this season because they remind us that the light is always present even in the darkest of nights. And for this reason, I love burning candles this time of year, not only because they keep the light in my consciousness in the midst of darkness, but also because of the soft, muted, hospitable quality of light that candles emit. One of the great lights in my life, and I know in the lives of many of you listening tonight, is Andrew Harvey. Andrew has been a friend and companion on my path for several years, and one of the things I share so proudly with Andrew is a reverence for all things dark and dreary, because we know that if we open ourselves to the darkness and become a student of its hidden wisdom,
yes,
we will discover unspeakable treasures of light, love, beauty, and wholeness. This is also a season of giving, and life is constantly offering us opportunities to give our time, our love, our resources, and our hearts. Industrial civilization has taught us to be stingy and terrified that there isn't enough to go around, so we have to clench our fists and desperately hang on to our resources. One of the lessons I've discovered about this in recent years is that the more I give, the more I actually receive.
Yes.
Paying it forward always, and I emphasize always, comes back to me materially and in many other ways. So Andrew comes to us tonight with a story that I haven't read much about in the news, which is also an opportunity to all of us to give to people who had nothing to begin with and now have less than nothing. So we're going to be talking about a number of things other than this story that he's bringing us, but I want us to begin with this one. First, for anyone who doesn't know, Andrew Harvey is the founder and director of the Institute of Sacred Activism, an international organization focused on inviting concerned people to take up the challenge of our contemporary global crises by becoming inspired, effective, and practical agents of institutional and systemic change. Andrew was born in the south of India in 1952 and later graduated from Oxford and also taught at Oxford, Cornell University, and Hobart and William Smith Colleges. He's the author of more than 30 books and is a scholar of the mystical Persian poet Rumi. His website is andrewharvey.net. His biography is very extensive, and I could elaborate even further, but I'd rather give Andrew the microphone because I know that what is weighing on his heart tonight is extremely important for all of us to hear and respond to. So I welcome my dear friend Andrew Harvey to the Lifeboat Hour.
Thank you so much, Carolyn, for that gorgeous and totally unmerited introduction. Very encouraging. Thank you so much. And such beautiful honoring. Thank you. And back to you for all your heroic work.
Thank you.
I think that what is weighing on my heart is the knowledge that the entire world is now going through a major breakdown, and disasters are proliferating. And we're entering a period in which disasters of all kinds are going to proliferate. So we need to now start evolving simple, personal ways of responding to these disasters with deep compassion, so long as we have resources to respond with.
Right.
And what happened to me is that I was in India and I had my green card stolen after going to Ladakh, where I heard about the floods in Kashmir that had devastated Srinagar, and was deeply, deeply disturbed, but didn't know that I was going to have my whole life overturned, my green card taken, and be compelled to stay in India and to go back to one of the places that means most to me, in Mahabalipuram, and meet there a Kashmiri family very close to me already who had lost their house during the flood. So this wild, chaotic initiation.
Well, let's back up just a bit. Can you tell us about the flood? What actually happened?
What happened was that at the end of August, massive floods started to invade Kashmir. The Srinagar River, the Jamuna, rose, and massive flooding occurred. Hundreds of thousands of people lost their houses. There were a few hundred deaths. But the destruction was immense. It was one of the biggest natural disasters in recent times. The publicity was badly handled because the Indian government wanted to pretend that it could deal with this massive disaster itself and didn't want foreign help. So it was played down. The Indian government promised great funds to go to people. They never arrived, or they're held up in bureaucracy, or they're not properly being distributed. It's insanity, as always, with the Indian government. So you have a massive disaster, which is also a humanitarian disaster, which is also a disaster of destroyed habitats and destroyed livelihoods. And now they're in the winter. They're in winter now.
Yes.
And the money hasn't really come properly. People are just doing the very best they can to survive, but it's very tough. So what I've really decided to do is to start something called Sacred Activism Kashmir as the first of a series of projects which are going to be very simple, very humble, not at all spectacular, very pure in their intention, to mobilize support from myself and my group of people for the sacred activists so that when disasters come, we can respond to it in a way that shows our solidarity with it.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So this is a really very simple project to raise $50,000 for the rebuilding of four houses and a school. And the two houses that I know from my two families that I already know, and then two other houses, and then a school that has been destroyed. So at the end of it all, we will know that four people have their homes rebuilt, and a school that is doing excellent work in the education of women will be rebuilt. This isn't changing the face of the disaster, but it's responding with precise tenderness and compassion to a group of people that really need help. And I've been very moved by my own emotional transformation coming into this cause, because I love the family that awoke me to this cause. They're very remarkable people, humble and decent and extraordinarily responsible people. And I was initiated through them into the beauty of the traditions of Kashmir, the spiritual traditions, of the traditions of handicraft. So Kashmir became a love affair of the heart. And then to think of these people who worked so hard being in such difficult circumstances because of this broke my heart, so that I gave everything that I'd earned in Ladakh and in Australia away as the foundation of the project, because I felt I couldn't ask other people to contribute to these kinds of projects if I didn't really just fertilize the soil with my own money, because what does it mean if it doesn't come from that impulse? So with that foundation there and the help begun and the team assembled, I've just sent out a big letter spelling out my absorption with the Kashmiri cause at this moment and the reason why it's so important and the reason why I feel this must really take place now, because they truly need the help now, because it's winter. We need the rest of the money. We've raised about 8,000, which is wonderful, in a week. But there's 42 to go, and it would be so simple if everybody just gave $30 or $40, just simply. And the way to do it is to go to my website, and you'll see that there's been a way of paying through PayPal. You can either buy something I've done or just give something simple generously. Because if we mobilize this kind of power, this kind of simple power, by getting together to help in ways when disaster strikes, then it'll be one more way we empower ourselves with the energy of divine compassion in what's going to be a very, very difficult transition, as we all know.
Yes, and I wanted to encourage everybody to go now to Andrew's website, andrewharvey.net, and right there on the homepage, you're going to see some photos, and you're going to learn more about how you can help. We really, really need to reach out and reach deep and give to this cause, because we are, as I said, talking about people who started with nothing and have even less than nothing now.
Yes,
and as Andrew is planning to, you know, continue to have projects like this in the future, as we see domino effects of spiraling disasters. So,
yes.
You know, this is just one.
Well, this is a key one. This is the one that I hope will start them all, because
yes,
I have many in my heart and mind. There is a project that I've been supporting in the Sudan, which is trying to build a school in an area which is very difficult to get to, but needs it desperately. There's a project that I have very much at heart in Australia amongst the Aborigines. There are many projects that are truly very important to me, but this one is a way we can begin this intention of sacred activism to turn up in a very simple humanitarian way. I'm trying to do it very simply, and some people are saying, well, why are you just building houses and building a school? Why aren't you trying to change the ideology of Kashmir or something? The reason is I want to do something very simple. I want to do something that is as simple as the crisis we're going to go through. Let's get real about what we're all going to face. We're all going to face massive precariousness. There's going to be tremendous ecological shifting of crusts, and we could easily be in the storm center. There's no safety on an Earth which is terribly disturbed ecologically.
Well, on that note, you know, as I said a moment ago, there wasn't much reporting about this, which you have repeated.
Yes.
And so there was a story in International Business Times, September 14th, entitled Kashmir Floods Caused by Climate Change, Environmental Degradation, and
That's
Unplanned
it.
Growth. Now, clearly this tragedy is directly related to climate change, and it seems to indicate that the new normal is extreme weather and environmental disaster.
Completely.
Can you say more about this, Andrew?
Well, the whole of that area has been through immense shifting through climate change, because the glaciers are melting, the Himalayas are melting, the terrible droughts also afflicting the rivers, which are going into terrible drought and filth and pollution. So you're living in an immensely troubled, immensely disturbed ecologically climate, with rising rivers through the snowmelt, and, of course, tremendous fertile destructions. I mean, tremendous droughts. So it's very, very disturbed country.
Yes. And, you know,
and
during this past
been,
year, you and I have had some very profound conversations about climate change and the likelihood of near-term human extinction. And it was really at your suggestion that Guy McPherson and I decided to write Extinction Dialogues, How to Live with Death in Mind. And then you wrote the foreword for our book, which in the usual Andrew style is a no-holds-barred, incisive look at our predicament and a beautiful articulation of what Guy and I were laying out. What do you see as the most important inner work that we can be doing at this daunting time in human history? And what should we be doing externally? I'm pretty sure that you're not going to tell us to sit quietly and wait for countries to pass laws that will reverse climate change, as if that were even possible.
That's right. You've got to really get real about the extremity of the crisis. This is much too late to hope for some transformation of the heart, changing everything, or people getting together and bringing in the new world. This is a time when we have to face things as they are and start responding to catastrophe with a pure heart. It's very important, this kind of active, simple, no-holds-barred, ordinary, extraordinary compassion, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
Otherwise, what are we?
Well, yes. And, you know, when we express our compassion, it's really important to understand that doesn't mean that we're going to change the larger picture of things.
No.
What we're going to do is make a difference for maybe a few living beings, but we're doing it because it's the right thing to do, because we cannot not do it.
That's it. And it doesn't have to. The beautiful discovery is that you don't have to be changing the world with every gesture to live a totally meaningful life. In fact, you can be living a life of the greatest meaning when you know that things can't be shifted, but you're just offering your life in prayer and in beauty to do sacred work just for the sake of it.
What does it do for you to do sacred work for the sake of it? How does that inspire and buoy you up?
Well, I think it frees me from any kind of agenda that I may have, that the work that I'm doing is for the particular end, or to wake people up, or to try and save people from committing world suicide. That's a huge agenda. And it's the subtle ego's agenda. So when I'm freed from that in play and in real, real humility, just to dance with the moment and to give myself completely to the moment, then something fresh, something new always arrives. And whatever the circumstance, I find myself in a state of joy and purpose, because it is the energy of love that is coming.
Well, you know, earlier this year, we had a conversation, which is on my website now at carolynbaker.net, and we talked about catastrophic climate change.
Yes.
And you inspired me to write an article called When Surrender Means Not Giving Up, the New Sacred Activism. And you,
yes.
One of the phrases that you use that I just love so much is you talked about the triumphalist agenda. Can you say more about that?
Well, I think that the human ego tends to make a parade of its achievements at all moments. So we have now a triumphalist fake mysticism, the New Age mysticism. It's all going to be fine. All we have to do is vibrate, which is, of course, complete nonsense. And also a triumphalist activism that somehow we're going to act in ways they're going to shift this terrifying crisis and transform it and bring in the Garden of Eden. And both of these are fantasies. We have to see the situation as it truly is. We're in terrible shape, in a crisis spiraling out of control, in which we're going to have to learn how to negotiate with great humility and skill impossible situations with great love.
I'm speaking tonight with Andrew Harvey, founder and director of the Institute for Sacred Activism, author of more than 30 books, and a scholar of the mystical poet Rumi. You can learn more about Andrew's work and how to help the people of Kashmir at his website, andrewharvey.net. So, Andrew, here we are at winter solstice. First of all, what does winter solstice mean to you, and why is it so important to honor, embrace, and work with the darkness in ourselves and in the world?
Well, for me, winter solstice is the holiest of moments, because it's the birth of the first light of a new order out of the depths of the deepest darkness. So It's the season in which the great secret of death and rebirth as the core of the universe, this massive dance of opposites, is revealed. And that is a very holy initiation. So for me, this is a time of offering my whole being to the transformation of the light, but also an offering of my whole being to be seen by the primal pure eye of the light, so as to be exposed to itself, so as to face the shadows that are eating away its own truth. And that double living of the one experience is essential to the divinization process, because you have to, on the one hand, live your glory and also live your dereliction. And trust that living your dereliction and the dereliction of the human race and the dereliction of your shadow and the dereliction of the hopeless craziness of the situation actually makes you more authentic, more real, more loving. And that is an astonishing transformation for which you don't need hope. You just need the experience of being crushed by reality into the truth of divine love for no reason, just for love's own sake. That's liberation. That is freedom. And this time can provide it, because this time has no illusions left. There are no illusions left.
Right.
We've run out of illusions.
We absolutely are. And as you spoke about hope, I was flashing on T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets. And, you know, he says, wait without hope, for hope would be hope for the wrong thing.
Yes.
And I see so much of the, you know, I call it hopium that we see all around us, being hope for the wrong thing.
Yes.
But you're talking about hope for the right thing, which is hope for death and rebirth.
Yes, and hope for the divine consciousness to become conscious in you.
Yes.
That's the only authentic, lasting hope. Because without that, you're in a dream, in a stupor. And with it, you can negotiate whatever's happening with some calm, grace, and compassion.
Well, you know, a moment ago you mentioned the New Age, and from time to time you and I are written off as being New Age, which I find hysterical, since calling us New Age really reveals a jaw-dropping lack of understanding of what New Age actually is.
Yes.
So I'd like you to talk about what New Age actually is from your perspective and why it's so lethal to our waking up and becoming conscious. And feel free to rant.
Well, for me, I think the two things that are most absurd about the New Age are the belief that you can become divine without having to go through the complete death of your false self and the shadow and illusion, really be excruciated by the depths of the shadow as well as illumined by the heights of the light. It just completely wipes out the whole shadow aspect of illumination, thus making a completely fake mysticism, which has no reality and no alchemical truth and no transformational truth, is a pack of lies. The second thing is connected, and that is that the New Age, in the mask of mystical pursuit, becomes a vast orgy of narcissism, just a completely banal, vulgar orgy of narcissism in which mysticism is reduced to manifestation, to the manifestation of what life your deranged ego thinks it wants. So in both cases, the essential truth of mystical transformation, that it is about death and rebirth, the death of the false self through the acceptance of the pain of the world, and through the analysis of the shadow, the making conscious of the shadow, and through the acceptance of heartbreak and the terror and horror of living potentially at the end of the planet, trying to bring in grace even in ultimate suffering and chaos. That's really what we're facing, isn't it?
Oh, it absolutely is. And I love what you say about the about heartbreak, because we've had on this show, and then I just had as a guest in my webinar, which concluded last night, a man named Jack Adam Weber, who is a doctor of Chinese medicine on the Big Island of Hawaii. And he's written wonderful articles and poems on the power of heartbreak. Wow. And I love that phrase, the power of heartbreak. How does that grab you?
Well, the power of heartbreak is the ultimate power of divine love, I think, because until you have let your human heart be shattered open by two things in the divine, the beauty, the incredible, astounding beauty, which just reduces you to oceans of tears, of longing, that beauty, and also the violence, the craziness, the cruelty, the wildness in the divine, that also you have to have been able to fall in love with. So it absolutely is the key to the transformation, because without heartbreak, you'll never get real about what's really going on in the world, and without heartbreak, you'll never find where your heart breaks uniquely in relationship to the great suffering of the world, so that you discover your mission, which is always at that intersection of the world's heartbreak and your personal heartbreak.
And I find that sometimes it's very difficult for activists to really allow their hearts to be broken and experience the grief that they feel, that they have the passion, they have the fire, they have the commitment to make change, but that, you know, they sometimes burn out because that fire is so strong, and there's not enough tears, there's not enough water to balance that passion. What do you think about that?
Well, I think this is the great problem, and I think this, many activist groups are waking up to this problem and the need for a more nurturing and nourishing and long-term activism, fueled by sacred practice, fueled by psychological exploration, fueled by steady periods of peace, because we cannot go forward if we aren't steady. This is the great paradox of this crisis. On the one hand, we have to face the potential extinction of everything, which is, of course, shattering on every level. And on the other hand, we have to do it in a way that is peaceful and harmonious and balanced and decent and kind-hearted and deeply attentive to every species. That's a koan that is almost unimaginable to wrap your mind against around, isn't it?
It is, and I have really discovered in my work and my work with other folks that the more we can grieve, the more that facilitates doing exactly what you just talked about.
Exactly. The more we can let the sobs out, let the outrage out, let the anguish and the desperation out, and stop pretending we're not feeling it. But don't let it out in a way that paralyzes you. Let it out in an atmosphere of adoration and deep unity with experience, realizing that what you're letting out is your relationship with it. So you can work with it. It's wonderful manure for revelation.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't it?
Oh, indeed. Yes. It absolutely is compost for even more growth, and compost for the community, you know, because when I'm able to grieve, I'm not only releasing something from myself, but I'm helping to detoxify my immediate environment.
Oh, God, yes.
Yeah.
Well, in a certain way, don't you think the coma that we're in is the depth of our refusal to grieve?
Absolutely.
And that people, we're in this massive coca coma, this massive subduing of all normal senses of conscience, of reactivity, of decency, waiting for the world really to be destroyed, doing so, so little, because we have made a kind of horrific inner decision not to feel the consequences of what we've created.
Yeah, I just have to say, the first time I heard you use that expression, Coca-Coma, we were walking together down a street in Denver, and I had not heard that expression before. And you know, it came out of your mouth, and I nearly fell to the ground laughing, because it is so spot on in terms of how you know, corporate capitalism and industrial civilization has anesthetized us to being in this coma where. You know, like today, all over the headlines, you know, it's like I can't get away from North Korea hacks into the Sony movie. You know, it's like, please, could we talk about something else? Could we talk about the 8 kids that were killed in the same week in Australia as the terrorist attack there? I mean,
it's craziness, isn't it? It's a very obsessive cycle now.
And you've written and spoken volumes, Andrew, over the years about the human shadow. And of course, you and I both know that the New Age spirituality that you were just talking about is the shadow of the most brutal fundamentalisms.
That's
on
it.
Earth.
Another kind of fundamentalism, because the New Age fanatics are fundamentalists sometimes in their dismissal of the dark, in their complete incomprehension before evil, in that absolute fanaticism of cheerfulness. They're fascists. They really do come off as fascists sometimes. Terrifying.
And yes,
to
and
me.
The shadow, their shadow is, well, in present time, the human shadow is being unmasked everywhere as we witness the depths to which humans have sunk. And the extinction of species is one face of this horror, as are torture programs by a nation that declares itself above such evil.
Yes.
And one of my favorite examples of human madness this week was groups of people taking selfies in front of the building where the catastrophic Sydney hostage situation was unfolding.
Yes.
And I'd love to hear your thoughts on these eruptions of the shadow in our industrially civilized world.
Well, I think the fundamental truth is that we're living through a massive volcanic eruption of the shadow at all levels throughout the world. I think this is the essential nature of the crisis. All the institutions are being exposed as bankrupt and as corrupt. Look at the scandals in the Catholic Church, look at the scandals in the corporations, look at the ultimate scandal of Wall Street not having to pay anything for crippling the world's economy and robbing so many people of their life savings.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's insanity what we've lived through, don't you think?
Yes, and when I was mentioning the selfies, you know, the people were taking,
yes.
and this is now the new thing, take a selfie, it's so indicative of our narcissism and our entitlement, don't you think?
I think that there's everything has become virtualized in some strange, terrible way.
Mm-hmm.
I just saw Nightcrawler with Jade Gyllenhaal when I was in LA, and it's about a man who makes his money by photographing extreme situations like killings and accidents. And it's about our obsession with drama through voyeurism. And I think we're all in that, don't you? I think it's almost impossible to get clear for the inner life from that crazy, chattering, narcissistic drama that is this febrile, crazed culture dying on crack.
And, you know, it's very difficult. I work with a lot of people who contact me for life coaching regarding, you know, the personal struggles they're going through around collapse and near-term extinction and, you know, how to navigate this, in other words. And, you know, I hear so many people talking about how they spend so much time online, reading Facebook or other sites, and they're constantly trying to validate what they know, and they're trying to constantly have some kind of community, a virtual community. because they're very lonely and they're very starved for connection. But they find themselves just obsessing, and almost addicted to being online and learning more, as if somehow if they just get more information, then they'll know what to do. And it's very hard for people who've become accustomed to doing this to stop. I don't mean entirely stop, never go to those places again.
But to attend to the soul,
and turn inward.
That's it.
And become familiar with the inner plane, with the inner milieu, and what's really going on inside, because that is what we ultimately have to struggle with. You know, as Guy McPherson says, and I say in our book, you're going to die. You know, so what are you going to do with your life in between now and then? How will you serve other people? How will you make a difference for other species, making things easier on other living beings? You know, it's all about what's on the inner plane and then taking that outward to make a difference.
Absolutely.
And that's very hard for people enculturated in this Western civilization to understand, and they have to just, you know, experience it, I think, in order to get it. But it's very hard to discipline oneself to experience
it. Or a bankruptcy or a great illness or a collapse or something or other, because the Western world has set up its lives so steely and so focused. It's very hard to break that track except through disaster, don't you think?
I do. And I think, you know, very often that, you know, we have to be pulled down.
Yeah.
Down and inward, you know,
very much into
the body or into the heart, for us to really get where the real action is, which is on the inner planes.
Exactly. And that's where the whole crisis is taking us, to that shattered openness in which we find reality and each other for the first time with fresh and tender love beyond reason and beyond agenda. That's the only place. That's reality, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And, you know, this takes me back then to the people in Kashmir. And you spent a great deal of time over there this summer and fall. And so how are the people on a day-to-day basis in their community dealing with this? What are their relationships
like?
Well,
I think the first thing is that they truly get how crazed and corrupt the Indian government is. They don't expect anything to come through there because they know that they've been promised stuff and it hasn't arrived. They're very stoic, uncomplaining people. The second is that they are very much family people. This is an Islam of the family. This is not the crazy Wahhabi kill everybody Islam. This is traditional Islam, which is very self-respecting but not fanatical, which really honors other religions and which is very dignified. So their Islam is an Islam that honors family and the selflessness of mutual help. So they really get together and truly, truly help each other as far as they can with whatever resources they can. For example, a family I know took in to its already crowded house, six more people. I think it was seven more people, which I think all of them had to live in one room. But they were so happy to welcome in their cousins and their aunt. That was really moving to see the level of the depth of the Islamic family, the way in which people truly honor each other and truly treat each other with direct compassion. Very moving. And I think that that's what makes me so honored to be able to help these people, because they're not asking for a handout. They're not people who are greedy. They're not people who are into a victim story. They're very responsible people who have been completely sideswiped and had their houses annihilated and their livelihood annihilated. They've just been catastrophized and traumatized by it. So they're really very, very clear about how to get back through hard work and through gratitude and through faith and through family to the old truth of living decently. They know how to get back. They've got a very strong inner training. So this is why I feel this project is so beautiful. I hope I'm able to convey something of what I feel.
Well, you absolutely are. And I was just thinking as you were talking about the ways the families pull together and support each other, that in itself must be a huge culture shock for people growing up in industrial civilization to just witness that firsthand. I've witnessed that firsthand with other cultures, and it is beyond heartwarming.
It's so amazing. It's because it's so natural. People really naturally think about other people apart from themselves. They really do care about everybody in the family's livelihood, how they're going to be fed, what food's going to be on the table, how the if there's going to be a house that could be big enough for them to all live in simply, calmly. I mean, it's so amazing to encounter love that uncomplicated and grounded.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
And that's why I'm honoring, for me, giving to them, and I have given extensively to help rebuild, has been a joy and an honor, because I've been giving to a way of life that is giving so much to me. The more I come to understand it and feel it, the more I am touched by it. So it doesn't feel at all like starting a system of charity. It feels like starting a festival of gratitude for a culture that has got nobility and steadiness and stamina and the capacity to make do with little and wait with patience and work with what's given in sane ways to restore and rebuild. This is very moving. This is how we're going to have to be ourselves, I think, in the future. We can learn so much from helping, but we can also learn so much from watching how these ancient and dignified cultures work with our help and take our help and really do get back to dignity through hard work, through immense, clear hard work. They just know how to do it. They're so humble. And
well, speaking of ancient and dignified, among your many gifts, Andrew, is your laser insight into the mystical Persian poet Rumi. And I know you're also working on a book right now about the mystical Indian poet Kabir.
Yes.
Why do you think that after more than 700 years, so many people are returning to the wisdom of Rumi in this very dark hour?
I actually think it's the divine grace itself that is making available to the whole of humanity at its darkest hour the ultimate mystical truth of the relationship of the beloved and the beloved, the ultimate revelation of love, to inspire us and to give us courage and energy to rise to this terrifying tragedy that we're in with tremendous divine love and grace. And Rumi is the supreme mystical poet of the alchemy of the dark night into the resurrection, the alchemy of horror into more dazzling order, the alchemy of terrible heartbreak into the deepest and tenderest love. So he's the ordained guide for our heart transformation, which is going to have to be as extreme as his and will be. But we'll have him as a guide into the enormous new love that can be born if you let yourself be shattered open and shattered free.
You know, Rumi doesn't hold our hand and tell us that everything's going to be okay at all.
Absolutely not.
He pulls no punches and shatters our optimism with wrenching realism, alongside the blazing ecstasy of one who celebrates aliveness with each breath.
Yes.
And so I'm wondering if you'd share some passages from Rumi that you believe the world needs most right now.
Well, I think the first passage it needs most is this great, great poem of the dark night, because this is the process, I believe, that we're in, this terrible, sitting, searing, burning, flaying process that is just not going to stop until we become radically changed and authentic. The poem goes like this. The grapes of my body can only become wine after the winemaker tramples me. I surrender my body like grapes to his trampling, so my inmost heart can blaze and dance with joy. And although the grapes go on sobbing blood and screaming, I cannot bear any more cruelty, I cannot bear any more cruelty, the winemaker trampler stuffs cotton in his ears and says, I am the master of this game. And when, by my grace, you reach my perfection, you will never be done praising my name. I think that's the most extraordinary poem of The Dark Knight, because it's so tender and so ruthless at the same time.
It is one of my favorite Rumi passages, and I read it over and over again in the various versions that people have written. And you have this wonderful album that you made with a composer, Hans Christian, right?
Yeah.
A couple of years ago. And it's called The Rumi Symphony.
Yes,
and
I love that.
There are two discs, and one is Andrew reading this incredible Rumi poetry, and the selection that he just read is one of those, with this amazing orchestration behind him, and then the other disc is purely instrumental. But do you have access to reading that again, that passage that you just read?
Yes.
Okay. Would you read it again for us? Really, really think it's important.
The grapes of my body will only become wine after the winemaker tramples me. I surrender my body like grapes to his trampling, so my inmost being can blaze and dance with joy. And although the body goes on screaming, I cannot bear any more cruelty, I cannot bear any more cruelty, the trampler stuffs cotton in his ears and says, it is I who am the master of this work. You can deny me if you want. You have every excuse. But when, through my passion, you reach perfection, you will never be done praising my name. That's the real version. It's a more beautiful version, I think.
Well, you know, I think that that very passage that you read absolutely captures the intention of my work, because, you know, for 7 years I've been writing about what has to happen to us, what needs to happen to us in this process of collapse and transformation, that we have to be trampled so that the wine can come forth. And if we can allow this trampling vintage experience, that we will never be done giving thanks.
Right. Because it will finally boot us free of our narcissism, because everything being shattered in front of our eyes will finally get us onto our knees. And when we do get on our knees, we'll be rewarded by love flooding in.
Absolutely.
It's the key, isn't it? It's the way in which this vision of extinction and the release of the human heart are connected directly.
It's, absolutely, yes.
We can live this with absolute surrender and real joy.
Well, I'm wondering, as we come down to the end of our time together, what are some of your upcoming events and projects? You've told us a little bit about further projects regarding helping people in disaster. But what else do you have coming down the road?
Well, I think that the things that I'm thinking, thank you for asking me, but I think I'm really trying to reach out in my work. I feel I've done a lot of the building of the foundations of sacred activism and the work that I've done and the teaching I've done and the institute I created. But I want to reach out now and do things that are really directly connected to the suffering of the planet. That's why doing this planet, I know, sacred activism, Kashmir, is extremely important to me because it's really helping so-called ordinary people going through absolutely extraordinary horror and distress with direct help. That, to me, is a very important part of sacred activism. I want also to reach a larger audience with the truths that have been entrusted to me and to all the other teachers at this time, because it's so important to reach beyond the choir. And I've been working in Hollywood with an amazing Iranian film director on a script about Rumi, this great transformation, this great, huge, majestic, terrible transformation that cost a great deal in the lives of everybody around Rumi. So we're trying to do a script that is both believable and extremely human and extremely painful and extremely beautiful, that will tell the huge whole story, which has never really been told before in the cinema. So that's very exciting.
Oh, indeed.
And I'm just also loving being at home, because I think almost the most exciting thing for me these days is having peace at home with my cats, so that I can really re-enter myself and come back to myself. I've been traveling a lot, and I love my life, but it is, as for all of us, I think, at this moment, if we're turning up truly to serve, it's very demanding, and we need to also have those periods of temple quiet, of retreating, and that's what I'm about to enter for 10 days over Christmas, so I'm very overjoyed at that.
Well, you live, by the way, in the Ozarks in the United States, and you live in a gorgeous area of incredible natural beauty, and I know that it feeds your soul, just as my living here in Colorado, close to the mountains, feeds my soul.
Oh, God, yes.
So I'm so happy for you that you're able to stop and pause and have this retreat experience in the next few days, and may it be sweet.
Thank you so much, and so much luck on the Extinction Dialogues as they really start coming out. It's a very important book you've done with Guy, and it's a very important book for everybody to read and to take deep into their hearts, because everything that we've been speaking about, I think, really has its base in that book, has its core in that, accepting the possibility of what that book describes. And this is such an important advance, an evolutionary advance for the human race, and it potentially can open the heart completely to reality, to loving everything without agenda, which is the truth of divine love and of human divinity. That's the key.
Well, thank you so much, Andrew Harvey, for coming on the Lifeboat Hour. It is always a joy and delight to have you. To even speak with you on the phone is my highlight of my day.
Thank you, Danny, and I thank you so much for your work and your love
and your huge heart.
Thank you all very much. And please help my sacred activism, Kashmir, and give liberally, because these people truly need it, and every single cent will go directly to them. And I'm so grateful in advance for your generosity and kind attention to this.
Thank you, Andrew.
It's over. Everybody knows that good guys lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor. The rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows. Everybody knows the boat is leaking. Everybody knows the captain lied. Everybody got this broken feeling, like their father or their dog just died. Everybody talking to their pockets. Everybody wants a box of chocolates and a long stem rose. Everybody knows. Everybody knows that you love me, baby. Everybody knows you really do. Everybody knows you've been faithful, give or take a night or two. Everybody knows you've been discreet. but there were so many people you just had to meet without your clothes. Everybody knows. Everybody knows. Everybody knows. That's how it goes.